How you doing, Met fans? Welcome to another edition of the Terry Collins Show. I'm John Arezzi, and joining me from Port St. Lucie, Florida, the former skipper of the New York Mets and analyst for SNY's Baseball Night in New York, Mr. Terry Collins. Terry, as always, welcome back for another week. I know you celebrated a birthday this past Monday on Memorial Day, so happy birthday to you.
Thank you, John. Thank you. It was a big one, too. You know, it's one of those, you know, I talked to a lot of my friends. They called and said, happy 75th. I said, well, I've just entered the fourth quarter. So yes. we got to do the best I can to, you know, keep myself going. But certainly it's good to be get back on the show and have some talks with some great people and talk some baseball.
Absolutely. You know, and Memorial Day means so much to all of us. It's a day we remember those who served in the military and gave us the ultimate sacrifice. And this Memorial Day, one very special organization made the lives of 36 families of fallen heroes better by delivering mortgage-free homes to them across several states. And Terry, that's going to bring us to a very special announcement here on the show today. And of course, you're aware of it. You've spent some time with these individuals, and we are pleased. And no, actually, we're more honored to announce that the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has joined us here as the presenting sponsor of the Terry Collins Show. And we could think of no better organization, no better teammates to have with us. Since the tragedy of 9/11, Tunnel to Towers has worked tirelessly to help first responders, Gold Star families, and our military veterans. If a fireman or policeman is killed in the line of duty, T2T will step in to pay those mortgages so the family doesn't have to worry about where they will live. They built smart homes for injured soldiers, and now they're building veteran villages to support our veterans who have fallen on hard times. So that association is real special, and each and every week here on the show, we'll bring you stories about the heroes who show the spirit of Tunnel to Towers in a new weekly segment that we call Amazing Hero of the Week. So we'll debut that first one later in the show today, and it'll feature none other than Pete Alonso of the New York Mets. And then we'll also bring on later in the show Mets Hall of Famer John Franco to discuss his involvement with the foundation. Terry, your thoughts about our new partnership with Tunnel to Towers?
Well, I cannot agree with you more, John. It's a tremendous honor, and I mean truly an honor. It's humbling to be associated with a tremendous foundation like Tunnels to Towers. I mean, you know, I've told you before, I happened to have the experience when I was coaching in Tampa Bay. We were the first team, American League team, back in the city. We played the Yankees and had a great some great talks with a number of the firemen, a number of the first responders, some EMTs, some policemen that were at 9/11. Wade Boggs was one of the coaches and actually got us access to get close to ground zero. Tremendous organization and what they do. And in the world today, John, with what we're facing in the world today, what an impact they're going to make on the lives of so many servicemen, first responders, police, firemen, no matter who it is, they now have somebody who's going to look out for them, and you can't ask for more than that.
No, they're an outstanding organization, and we've done some great things getting Alonzo. You did a PSA that they're going to start airing really soon, and Johnny Franco, we just shot a PSA with Johnny in New York about a week ago. And we'll have more players that will be associated with Tunnel to Towers as the season progresses. But we really appreciate the partnership, and it's just a cause that we're gonna enjoy creating awareness for here at the show.
You know, John, down here in St. Lucie, I work out at a gym here, and I work out with three former FDNY guys who have retired now. They live down here in Port St. Lucie. We work out. We talk every day. And all three of these guys are suffering from things that happened at 9/11. And they tell stories every day. We talk about it, and they tell stories. And I told them recently that we're involved with Tunnels to Towers. And I said, you know, what a great foundation. And you guys, you know, still cool to have somebody. And they looked at me and they said, there are people who need their help worse than we do. He said, yeah, we, you know, I got a real bad back. Another guy's got some issues inside. He said, there's people that need their help more than me. We are just thrilled to think that you guys would team up with Tunnels to Towers. So I thought it was a great, great compliment to the organization.
Yeah, certainly is. And they are such a wonderful foundation. And we'll be talking a lot about them during the season, and especially with the Amazing Hero of the Week. Those PSAs, those vignettes were shot so beautifully. So I think our listeners and the people who watch us on YouTube will really enjoy it. Terry, you know, segueing this week, not a lot of good news coming from the 2024 New York Mets. We're going to bring on Andy Martino in just a bit for talking with TC to discuss the team, do a little bit of a deep dive there. But I do want to ask you one thing. As a manager, did you ever kind of experience a stretch like this? And what can you tell a team who's undergone this type of stretch? It's been painful to watch, you know, as a fan, as somebody who follows the team. But give us your take on your memories of how it affected you and some of your teams if you went through something like this.
Well, I did. I went through it. Fortunately, not a lot. I was very, very lucky. But, you know, I went through two situations where, you know, things really got bad for a while. And the one thing I always tried to do, especially when I was a young manager, I approached it a little bit differently because I always thought I was responsible for how the team played. That it was, you know, hey, look, I didn't get them ready. I didn't get prepared well enough for that particular game. But you know what? I finally learned, you know what? They're big league players. They're good players. And you know what? All you can do is, you know, do all the things that you know that help get a team ready to play. And then they got to go play. And the one thing I tried never to do, especially here in New York, was show panic on my face or, you know, in the clubhouse. Look, we, you know, you stopped having the meetings where, you know, you're upset about something. Hey, look, we're a better team than this. And I know that's what Carlos is saying, because they are a better team than what they're playing. And fortunately, it's early. It's not ever fun to go through it. But if you're going to go through it early. So because now you can build from something, you can kind of reach back and say, hey, look, we got to get better at this. Because when you do it late, it's too late. You know, all of a sudden you wake up and you have a terrible September, you spend all winter stewing about it. If you do it early, you can get better. Because now, again, and I reached out and talked to Carlos Mendoza last week and, you know, didn't have a lot to say except hang in there. You're saying the right things. You're doing the right thing. You're being held accountable. You're holding the guys accountable. Now just, you know, go out there and they got to start playing better. They understand they're big league players. They know they're not playing well. They know now it's just a matter of making sure they stay positive. They keep working at the things they have to work at, not to try to do too much, but be the player that they are. You know, and when you're a manager, when you go in that clubhouse every day, you have to know what each and every one of those guys can do. And that's how, when you write your lineup, you know what you're going to get. And when you got it, now when you start expecting more from every certain guys or all of them, you're expecting more from all of them, you're going to have a tough time because they are as good as they can possibly be. Now you just got to get them good, get out there and go perform at that level.
Yeah, well, we'll be getting into that a little bit more with Andy Martino, and I'm sure, you know, Andy's right there every day in that clubhouse reporting on the team. So we look forward to getting Andy on shortly. But Terry, I want to go over some Mets history. And this week on your socials, you got a lot of happy birthday greetings. I mean, fans from everywhere were wishing you a happy birthday. But a lot of them also were wishing you a happy anniversary. So I thought it was really funny that May 28th, 2016, you and Noah Syndergaard, this is why everyone's wishing you a happy anniversary as well. It's like a happy ass in the jackpot day, happy give us a shot day. And there was so much of that on your social media this week. That was the day, of course, that you and Syndergaard were ejected against the Dodgers after Noah threw behind Chase Utley. It was the night you and umpire Tom Hallion had that animated discussion after the ejection leading to the famous ass in the jackpot comment. by Hallion that lives on to this day, courtesy of that leaked, mic'd up video that has now been seen by millions of fans across the world. So, Terry, happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I actually got some personal calls from some friends of mine that they realized it was the same day and called and said, you know, we watch the video once a week so we can have something to laugh at. So I'm glad I've put some humor in some people's houses this week.
Yeah, I mean, and that still, as far as everything that we've done during the course of this season, that interview with Hallion and that video, and that has gotten bigger numbers than anything that we've done all season long. People love it, and they watch it over and over and over again. And the fact that they're wishing you happy anniversary on it, that'll happen every year, I'm sure, is really quite funny. But what a great moment that was in 2016. And finally, on the Mets history this week, another pretty significant thing happened. June 1st, 2012, in the franchise's 8,020th game, Johan Santana throws the first Met no-hitter in Mets history. Johan threw 134 pitches, struck out 8 batters in that what became an immortal game for the New York Mets. Terry, I know that was one of your most emotionally draining games of your career. So bring us back and talk about that night.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's, I've relived the game several times, John, in my mind. Would I have done anything different? And the answer to this day would be, no, I would not have. I wish I, I've thought about it. I knew the importance of Johan to the club. He was on a long-term deal. Of course, one of the great pitchers in all of baseball, coming off an injury, was coming back after missing a year. But he's such a special human being and such a special person and such a great leader on the team. That night, you know, as that game went on, I can't tell you how many times I'd sat there and said, you got to go get him. You got to go get him. And my pitching coach would say, you know, hey, well, let's give him one more inning. And in the seventh inning, I walked down to the end of the bench and said, how you doing? And he said, and Johan looked at me, he said, TC, I'm fine. I'm fine. I did it in the eighth inning, walked down, said the same thing. And he said, don't worry about me. I'm fine. And that's when I told him, I said, well, you're my hero. And, you know, when the game was over, I couldn't have been more happy for anybody. It was a great thing. And through the years, I've heard, you know, some fans come to me and thank me for leaving him in. But certainly one of the great moments as the manager of the New York Mets was to have somebody throw their first no-hitter.
Yeah, what an amazing night that was. All right, Terry, thank you so much for that. Now it's time for Talking with TC. Our guest on this week's Talking with TC is currently an analyst for SNY covering the Yankees and the Mets. He covered Major League Baseball for more than a decade, a former staff writer for the New York Daily News and Philadelphia Inquirer. His brand new book, The Yankee Way, The Untold Inside Story of the Brian Cashman Era, is out and available everywhere. It's a pleasure to bring back to Talking with TC, Andy Martino. Andy, how you doing?
I'm better for it because I'm talking to TC. TC knows I'll do that anytime. How you doing, John?
Well, Andy, thanks for coming back on the show. It's been, you know, almost 6 weeks now since we first started the show, and I want to bring you back periodically to, you know, so we can talk about what's going on with the Mets. And I know you've been watching the games lately, and times are tough. Times are tough right now. So, you know, what are you hearing? What are you watching?
Well, it's surprising, Terry. I think you know what the most surprising thing is just the fact that they're not really doing any of the things that winning teams do. The defense, which we thought would be good, scoring, tacking on runs. That's one thing that I know the organization's been a little annoyed. Like, why aren't we driving in that additional run? Why aren't we putting any distance between us and other teams when we have a lead? Bullpen's running on fumes. I mean, unfortunately, it's just a lot of not so good stuff right now, which I'm sure you're seeing too as you're watching the games. And it's just kind of surprising. This is 2 years in a row now. I'm not saying this year is dead yet, like last year was, but 2 years in a row where we get to around Memorial Day and it's like, what's going on? This makes no sense. There's talent on this team. The one thing I'll say, I know that Mets, we watch the games, they got a million issues, like some of the ones I just said. But if they just had a closer who was converting his save opportunities, they'd be a lot closer to the 500 team that they thought they were going to be. So that's one sort of thing in their defense of the roster a little bit. No one could have seen Diaz this much of a disaster. And you can even put – so we're recording this the day after the doubleheader. Ottavino blew the save. On a way, that's a Diaz game too, right? Because Diaz would be in there if Diaz was right. So I think that's a huge, huge thing, just like it was in 2019 when they were in the wild card race and Diaz had a slump, and that was kind of why they were – why they fell out of it then too. So that's a big piece of it. But as you can see, just not a lot of winning baseball stuff happening anywhere at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've been watching a lot of the games lately. It's easier for me. I don't have a tough time when they're on the West Coast, but when they're at home or they're on the East Coast, I get to see the games played. And you're absolutely right. You know, and it's being obviously been in that dugout for a long time, going through some similar situations like that. And I know, you know, in this town, the constant pressure, from the media, and they're asking the tough questions when the game is over, those players, you know, they know they're not playing well. And sometimes, you know, once in a while, again, I think there comes a time when you just got to quit worrying about what's being said and just go play. Just go play the game the way it's supposed to be played. And I think sometimes you may have to put the numbers down. You got to, you know, put them back in the folder and let's just go play today. You know, we've talked about Andy, you and I, and we've done a lot of shows on different things. We talked, you know, the one time in Anaheim when we were in a slump, we weren't hitting. And so we decided to use one bat for the game. And oh, just yeah, to do something, right, to flip the switch the other way to where, hey, look, let's just go play the game the way we've all grown up playing it. And don't worry. I mean, everybody's so worried about the analytics and so worried about spin rates and exit velocities. And, you know, well, I'm watching games last night, and, you know, yesterday in the doubleheader, you had a squeeze bunt we didn't field and a couple of bloop singles that cost us runs, and totally, all those balls together didn't hit 75 miles an hour when you added all the exit velocities, but they produced runs. And so, yeah, there's just, you go through bad stages, and they're going through a bad stage right now. I feel terrible for Carlos. I, you know, reached out to him just to tell him to hang in there. And, you know, it's easier said than done when you're accountable for this stuff.
Yeah. That makes me want to ask you now. You reminded me of the bat thing, which was like, obviously lighten the mood a little bit, I'm sure, change the tone. But you and Carlos are similar in the sense that you're both like very passionate, and it's hard for you to shake off a loss too, because you're just as competitive as these players. But it's your job to set this tone where it's a little bit more big picture, right? Not so caught in the moment, but you got to help these guys mentally get to a better place. That would be really hard for me. If I'm upset about something, I'm probably going to wear it. So, and you know, you wear your heart on your sleeve too. So how does a manager take that step back and say, okay, guys, the sky is not falling. I know it feels like it. Let's smile. Let's have fun. Let's do something different. That's got to be really hard for you to get yourself to that place as a manager, no?
Well, yeah. I mean, especially during there's a stage where, Andy, all of the pent up frustrations you have as a manager, it doesn't help. And you can see it and you can feel it. Hey, look, this isn't, I'm not helping here. You know what? You can walk in so many times and tell them, hey, guys, relax, relax. We're better than this. Let's just go ahead. Let's go out and do our things. And then then all of a sudden you've got to do something about it. And that's where, okay, we're using a one bat today. We're going to take it out of their hands, put it in my own hands, say, okay, we're going to do this. I mean, I've watched this, you know, and I don't mean to criticize anybody, but yeah, yesterday was a Diaz day. But you know what, Andy? I've talked about it to a lot of guys, you know, golf might be one of the only games where you can actually go practice something to where you can take it from there onto the golf course. But you know what? All the bullpens in the world with nobody in that batter's box that's going to swing the bat doesn't, you know, unless you're working maybe on something different mechanically, it doesn't, you're not going to get much out of it. And same thing with batting practice. How many batting practices over the years have you walked in and watched guys beat down the upper deck until that game starts and that ball's coming at you? It's the same thing, you know, for years and years, you know, you take 1,000 ground balls, but it's all of a sudden with that winning run at third base. I go back to the Pedro Guerrero quote one time when Tommy Lasorda said to him, "What are you thinking out there?" And Pedro says, "I'm thinking, don't hit the ball to me, you know, because I don't want to be the goat in this situation." And so every so often you've got to just lighten up to everything and just say, "Boys, we're going to throw the bats and balls out there today. See it's 6:30. We're strapping it on. We're playing." Just to take some of the heat off. And I'm not saying that works, but there's got to be something here because I know this team's better than they're playing. They've got really a good lineup. And you know what? As I told Mendy when I talked to him, hey, your star players, they got to play like stars. And, it's nice to have some talented young players, but you can't ride those guys when the pressure's on.
Well, first of all, when you said Pedro Guerrero quote, I thought we were going in a different direction, but I'm not gonna linger on that for very long. I'm glad you did. Moving on from that thought, which I probably should have kept to myself. Yeah, it's tough. I'm sure like something's gonna click to lighten the mood, and the vibe probably won't be this bad all year. But figuring out what that thing is got to be really tough. And I agree with what you said. There's absolutely nothing a manager could do if your stars aren't playing like stars, which is obviously the case with Alonso. If you want to call Nimmo a star, Lindor, these are big boys and they're just not performing. There's no magic bullet to that, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you know, Andy, we talked about, and you were right. The bullpen does, you know, they're getting a little tired, but you know what? That's the nature of the game today. And one of the things I thought the Mets really did is they went out and they got themselves some extra pieces. They may be in AAA, but they've got guys who've got experience where sometimes you got to flip it up. But, you know, and until you're starting pitching, gets you deeper in the game to where all of a sudden, you know, and that's the other thing about our game today is there's no more matchups. You know, you can't bring a guy in today and have him get that last out in the eighth inning and then have him, you know, or he's got to get two outs in the eighth inning. Now you got to pitch to three guys. And so all of a sudden you're using 20 some pitches, maybe 22 pitches in an inning where before you could get out of an inning in three pitches, and you got them available for two more nights. And so, but you know, when you start bringing your relievers in the sixth inning and you got to get four innings out of your bullpen sometimes, and they are getting a little tired. That's tough. That's a tough ask.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. The three batter rule, I always think about being limiting for a manager's strategy, like in-game strategy. But that's a great point that instead of throwing – and Jerry Blevins, I used to think – and I love Jerry. I work with him now. But I used to think, man, that's pretty good money for two pitches every night or two. The fact that doesn't exist – now that same guy, you're right. He's got to get three batters out. So that's a way probably to get a bullpen gassed.
And you know, and I looked at it when they went to a six man rotation. My first thought is, holy cow, that's going to pull somebody out of that bullpen. And in today's game, unless that six starter is giving you, you know, six and seven innings, because they got a good enough team, though, you're going to be in some games. You've still got to go to your A guys in that bullpen. And you know, and you're looking at these guys who are pitching 3 and 4 days a week. They got to start getting a little fatigued.
How's that feeling as a manager when you're at the end of May and you can obviously see that your bullpen's pretty gassed and you don't see a ton in the system? It's like, are you like, what the hell am I going to do until September? Is a sense of, I don't want to say panic, but is that something that you'd be aware of?
Well, absolutely are. But, you know, again, I was absolutely blessed. Thanks to Sandy. I had Bartolo Colon. Who I said, you know, there were nights Bartolo would say to me, "I'll get you to the eighth. Don't worry about it. You know, no matter what the score is, don't worry about it. I'll be fine. I'll get us deep in the game. I'm going to save two of those relievers down there, and I'm going to take the beat. If it's a beating, I'll take it. And you got to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, years ago, I remember when I first started managing, Walter Alston told me one time. He said, "Don't be afraid to lose a game tonight, so that you can win a game tomorrow." And that is, don't be burning all your relievers tonight to look like, oh, I'm trying to win this game when you can't win it. And now tomorrow, when you have a chance to win it, you don't have anybody to win the game with. And it made a lot of sense to me, and I never forgot it. So there were nights where, you know, you not necessarily started. Maybe it's a guy that, of course, they were called long guys back then. You'd bring that long reliever and say, hey, I'll see you in the eighth inning. You're going to have to figure out how to get us there, but and I'll get you some 2 or 3 days off, but you got to get us deep into this game. So maybe, you know, and a lot of those good guys, you looked up and you're down. So you bring a long reliever and you're down 5-1 and you look up 3 innings later, it's still 5-1. And, you know, kept you in the game to be able to try to catch up. But, you know, those guys were invaluable, but it's tough when, you know, you're not getting length out of your starting rotation. And due to the number situation today, that's what you're going to get.
Yeah, for sure.
I think anyway. I think
you're right. You're right. I know you had a conversation with this with some pitching coaches recently, and it's a whole other issue in the game. But you're right. When pitchers are being developed to not go as long, and obviously the whole philosophy of you had Tyler Glasnow recently say something like, "I'm always going to choose to go full throttle," or however he put it. All, you know, maximum velocity, maximum spin, as long as you can go. So what was always struck me as like the missing piece of that is that you're going to burn out your bullpen. You're going to burn out your pitching staff with that approach over the course of the season. But, you know, there's smart people who think this is a good idea in the game, I guess, but it seems pretty obvious to me and you that there are some problems that arise with that. I don't think that the Mets are all in on that totally new school way of thinking so much as that they're just not getting the length though. You know, I'm not like David Stearns is not a guy who at this point I've heard talk about pitching in that super new school way. I know they have their pitching lab and the drive line stuff in their system, like just about everybody else does. But Stearns has been a little bit more like old school, for lack of a better term, in a number of ways that I expected. And so I think really it's more that the Mets just they have a rotation filled with what on a championship caliber team would probably be your third or fourth starter, and they're just not getting length consistently. I think maybe it's more that than their philosophy.
Yeah, and that could be. I'm not there. I'm just looking from the outside in and knowing the fact that I had to go through this a few times, you know, where, hey, look, you know, you got to condition your pitchers. You got to build them up to where, you know, 83, 85 pitches is kind of easy instead of all of a sudden they starting to wear down because there might be that game where, you know what, hey, look, you got to get us out of this inning. So, you know, because we just don't have the bullets down in the bullpen. But, you know, it also helps to know you're getting some offensive support. And, you know, so it's, when you go through a bad stretch like this, you don't just not one thing. I mean, when they're, you know, whether a tough play on the squeeze bunt last night. That's a tough play for a pitcher. Adam gave it his best shot to try to catch the ball in the air. And, you know, so, but it's where one play all of a sudden turns the game around, and that's when you're going through a bad stretch, that's what happens.
Yeah, Beatty losing the ball on the transfer there. You're right. It's not – I mean, that was obviously an error. But there was the other play. I believe it was in the game tying single by Freeman. I don't think it was the go-ahead, but anyway, it was a run-scoring single by Freeman in that inning where Beatty, to his left, just doesn't kind of get to the ball. And it's a moment like that. I don't know how many out of the 30 starting third basemen in the league get to that ball. I would assume a number of them do. But those are moments like that where I'm surprised, not in Beatty because he's always been bad, has always been his carrying tool, obviously, but that the Mets defense as a whole hasn't been tighter. We really saw with Bader and Joey Wendell. Joey Wendell thing was strange because he's such a solid utility guy, but he just didn't make the plays in the time he was here. Zach Short was supposed to be the same kind of guy. I definitely understand what you're saying about that play without Avino. But overall, are you surprised by their defense, team defense overall?
Well, again, I am because I think the shortstop's outstanding. I think he's a tremendous defender.
Yeah.
I think Brett has worked very hard to get better at third base. I mean, he's got himself in better shape. He looks like he moves a little bit better. Just that, you know, and Jeff is, for me, is a solid player no matter where you go. Pete's worked very, very hard at first. But, you know, just like yesterday, I think Harrison Bader is one of the best outfielders in the game. And all of a sudden, the one time he's got to make a ball.
Ball goes over
either got
head.
Up in the wind, maybe the ball got carried farther than he thought. But, you know, 19 out of 20 times, he catches that ball. And, again, when things are going bad, it gets over his head and you know, it becomes a big hit. So, it's just one of those things. But again, I think, you know, you got to get they're big league players and they know it and they know they're talented. But there's got to be something where you got to be able to just ease it, make it just, hey, let's just lighten up this thing a little bit. I told you one time, We just got set. We had a really bad game, and I came in and told the guy, "Hey, turn the music on. You know, we had a bad night. Let's move on." And Cespedes came in my office and said, "You don't care if we turn the music on?" And I said, "No." And the next day, he bought 2 10-foot speakers and put them in the corner of the clubhouse. You know, and so the guy, and again, just something to change the atmosphere a little bit. And even I know it's May, I get it. I've been there, but you know what? You want to get it turned as fast as you can, as soon as you can.
Well, if there's a trick to be found like that or a move to be found, I'm confident that Carlos is going to figure it out. Obviously, this is a guy who's got a good read on people, but that can't be easy because you must just want to be like, I need to do something right now, but you got to wait for something that has to come to you a little bit in the moment too. I'm sure you can't just force it. Something like culture thing like that. You have to wait. Hey, it's a moment where you say, turn the music on. It's a moment where you say, use the same bat. You got to let it come to you a little bit, probably as a manager, which has got to be really hard having that patience. You know, talking about Mendoza, the one thing I'll say is a positive around here that I was thinking about recently reminds me of something that Sandy said about you at the end of the 2011 season. Which obviously didn't end in a good, winning record or anything. So it is whether it was his end of season press conference or near the end of the season, we said, what positives do you take out of this season? And Sandy said, well, at least we found our manager. And you, of course, went on to become the longest tenured manager in the history of the team. And I think with Mendoza, however the year goes, they'll be able to say that this is the guy who, if they give him players, he's going to be really good. So that's probably the biggest positive we could take away from it right now. But I do think that they found their manager just as they did with you in that time. So
I totally agree. I tell you, Carlos is, he's accountable. He stands up, he defends his players. He, you know, says all the right things. I think he's really good. I think he's going to do just great, but I'm just saying right now with, and I know how it can be here, because especially before the season, well, we've got a playoff caliber team. You know, of course, 30 teams say that, to be honest, in spring training. Hey, we can make the playoff, which is true. But, you know, so when that heat comes on and you get it from so many people, you know, it's on the radios, it's on, it's right writers in the clubhouse, it's the fans, it's, you know, it can beat you down in there. And that's why, you got to pick the right time, but you know, you don't want to panic early. So if you're not going to panic, then you might want to do something else just to lighten the mood a little bit. It's a tough call, and I don't envy him. And, again, I've done it. I've tried to figure it out myself, but when I was there, not just there, but other places that I managed, when times were going good, and when you're young, boy, I'll tell you, you know, you want your team to play good, and that was I always blamed myself when we had bad games or bad weeks that I didn't get them ready, and it was always on me. And you know, once in a while, you know, you got to do something to show the guys, hey, look, the game's fun. It's a fun game. Yeah. Let's go play it with a great frame of mind. So, but it's easier said than done. I know that the talent, you know, I've always said, even in press conferences, you know, the other side of the guys on the other side of the field, they're big leaguers too, you know, and so their job's to beat you.
Right.
And so, and if they outplay you, they outplay you. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
John, anything for Andy? I know you've got lots of questions for him.
Yeah, it's got to be rough recently, Andy. I did read a piece you wrote for SNY. There's been a lot of talk about the Mets' core players, lack of success, not just this year, but in some previous seasons as well. That core, as people call it, Alonso, Lindor, Nimmo, McNeil, Diaz. You have your opinions on what that core means, that assumption, and also David Stearns, when he met the press this week, also commented on it. So talk to us about that assumption, that philosophy of core underperforming, and Stearns' assessment on what that meant as well.
Yeah, he pushed back on the question a little, which I thought was interesting. That's why I made that my column. He said he was asked, question, this core is only one playoff game over the past number of years, like what tells you that this is the right core, something along those lines. And he said, I think it's really hard to assess a team over a whole era or period of seasons based on a small number of players. Meaning, are the Mets, do the Mets have problems because of Lindor, Alonso, McNeil, or do they have other problems? How could we possibly say that it's not a winning core? Because I think you take those same players and put them with other set of variables, and they are a winning core. Are they winning players? Lindor is an authentic leader. He cares. He works. He has ways that make him a winning player in certain ways, even when he's not hitting. Alonso, far from a natural, like, first baseman, base runner, all these things, and he works to get better at those things. He cares. Diaz cares so much he was literally crying when he blew a save in Miami. My point is, like, these people aren't the reason that the Mets aren't performing. So to say that the core is rotten, that seems a little simplistic to Stearns. And I picked up on when he said that, and I kind of agreed with him. How can we say it's those players? What if it's the fact that they've had 100 different general managers since Terry left, or approximately, but it feels that way? What if it's the fact that the supporting cast could be better? What if it's the fact that the middle relievers are gassed? So I just don't think what's going on here is a comment one way or the other on that small group of players, because there's just too many other things going on. I'm curious if you agree with Stearns and me on that, Terry. When I say that, what do you think?
No, I think that's a legitimate point. I really do. I mean, you know, these are good players. These guys are good players. And, you know, and I know when you have good players, Andy, and I mean, I went through some stuff. And, you know, sometimes when you're a star player and your team's going bad, you look in the mirror and said, I got to take this over. You know, it's up to me to be the guy. And if you're not, you know, okay, there's that little piece of pressure that you've put on yourself now to be the guy. So maybe all of a sudden you open up the strike zone a little bit more because you've got to put that ball in play that maybe you take normally. And so you hit a little fly ball instead of getting seeing one more. And I lived it. I've lived it with some great players in New York. I mean, I remember one year, you know, David was absolutely on fire. David Wright was absolutely on fire.
Yeah.
And we were struggling a little, you know, we weren't winning enough games. And all of a sudden he took it upon himself. I got to be the guy. And that's what those good players do. They believe they can do that. And of course, now as the manager, I went to Dave and said, "Hey, you can only do what you can do." You know, someplace along the line, the other guys have got to help step up here. It's a team game. This is where it's a team game. And if you keep trying to do all yourself, you know, you're going to, first of all, wear yourself out. But you're going to start opening the strike zone and swinging too much. But those proud guys, and they're all proud guys in that clubhouse, they want to be the guy that gets them going again. And I get that. And I think that's kind of what they're saying. These core players, they're good. And like you said, you know what? If everybody was healthy and things would be different. But you know what it is?
Yeah.
You know, and I look back, I remember I did talk to John Franco about, you know, you think about it, poor Carlos Diaz or Edwin Diaz, you know, he missed a year. So,
yeah,
the game's not that easy. And so it may take him a while to get it all back, even though we all know he's still got the great arm. And if he's healthy, you know, you got to figure it out. But, I think that answer was good. And I thought what you said was very good.
Got another one on the trade deadline. Of course, now it's 2 months away. But now there's that speculation, especially when a team is not doing as well as people projected, that names start to filter and those rumors start circulating. And the name that's always front and center right now is Alonso. What can you tell us about things you've heard? What's the assessment right now? Is there now 2 months away from the deadline? The tough decision, are they going to sell off? What are they going to do? And is it, even though it's 2 months away, is it a disruptive element that seeps into the clubhouse with the players?
After I answer, I'd be interested to hear what Terry thinks of that one from an insight, even more insight perspective too. I would say these are human beings and it can't help but distract them to some extent. Baseball players are unbelievable at filtering out outside stuff. But at the same time, if you're Pete Alonso, say, and you don't know how the rest of your career is going to go or where you're going to be, I don't understand how you wouldn't think about that to a certain point. When the Mets as a group, they went through this last year, they were shocked at the clubhouse when Verlander went and Robertson went and then Scherzer went. And they it was like, well, what is this? We thought we were trying to win the World Series here. So whether that gets in their heads again, I think that's something for Carlos to try to get out ahead of maybe and lighten that mood a little bit. John, in terms of what I'm hearing is going to happen, look, they don't want to be in that position again. The Mets have no interest in taking another step back. I just talked to Steve Cohen about this and quoted him maybe a week and a half ago, where he said, I fully expect to make the playoffs. Now, he didn't get to be Steve Cohen by being stupid and denying reality. And if they keep losing, it is what it is. You have to deal with the reality. But their goal, they're not going into this year thinking, oh, we signed a bunch of one-year deal guys like Severino. Manaea's got a club option, same principle. Bader, who you can flip at the deadline. That wasn't the idea. The idea is ride these guys to the postseason. So that's their first preference. But I'll tell you that it's going to be different with Alonso than it was last year over the winter. Last year, there was a lot of noise about Alonso getting shopped. It wasn't really true. Billy Epler took calls about it, preliminary conversations, nothing close. In the winter, when Stearns took the job in the fall, he basically took even that notion off the table. He's not going to come in and trade Alonso right away. They're trying to win. And obviously, that's the right move. I think you want to see if you can – you know, the object of this thing is to make the playoffs and then win the World Series, as far as I can tell. So that's what their goal was. But again, they're not stupid. If this thing's not in a good place in a couple more weeks, they would have to seriously entertain the idea of trading Alonso. I think the holdup could be for half a season of a right-handed power hitter, are you getting the kind of prospect back that excites you and your fans enough to make it worth the disruption? I mean, we all know Alonso's got elite power, but half-season rentals for power bats, that's not usually going to get you that kind of like franchise-altering prospect. If you'd done it with a year and a half of control on Alonso, then maybe. But so they'd have to seriously see what's out there and consider it, but I'm not convinced they're going to get an offer that moves the needle for them.
And, you know, Andy, I agree with that. I will tell you, and I went through a place where we were going to trade some players, but you're right. One thing about it does affect the guys. I mean, Pete's made it public. He wants to be a Met forever. And so, you know, when all of a sudden you get traded away, you know, and he understands it's a business and everybody understands it's a business. Those things happen, especially if you don't think your team's going to be in it, you might get this guy, this one piece, because believe me, there's a team out there that said, this guy can put us in the playoffs or put us over the top to get us to where we ultimately want to go. They'll cough somebody up. I mean, as we know, there's sometimes bad decisions are made in critical times. True. I mean, how many Hall of Famers do we know were traded away? John Smoltz, Jeff Bagwell traded away in situations where they got a guy for just to get through the rest of, because they think they're going to win the championship. So, you know, you just never know what might happen. But I will tell you, when I talk to Carl, hey, look, in the next 30 days, you know, you figure you got 30 games, go win 21 of them, go win 20 of them. So, to where you're all of a sudden you're back to 500 and you look up and next thing you know, you're two games out of a wild card spot by the trading deadline and everything's great. This is what the tough part of the game is, to get through the low areas and low parts of the game. Yeah. And that's why you can't get too down and you can't get too high when things are good. This is a long season.
Yeah. Yeah. And they still have a chance to do that. And the expanded wild card obviously helps. This is making me think, I would say, Terry, one of the most downtrodden clubhouses at a trade deadline time that I've seen was yours in 2011. That was the year Beltran was traded, right? Yeah, 2011. And that was obviously the plan going in. They're going to see what they can get for Beltran at the deadline. It was going to be hard to change that plan that year. Different situation. Sandy and ownership that year didn't expect you guys to contend. But you're playing pretty well in the first half, all things considered. And I remember a sense of almost, I don't want to say shock, guys read and understand what's going on. But I remember being in the clubhouse and guys that were good for you that year, like Willie Harris, were like a little bit pissed. Like, why would the front office do this? We're fighting. And I remember coming into your office for the afternoon media thing. Where were we? I think we were in Cincinnati when they traded Beltran. Yeah. And you were obviously unhappy to lose the guy. Do you think, and this reminds me of last year, like I said before, when the Mets traded all those guys, Verlander and Robertson, Scherzer, the clubhouse is kind of shocked, and the reporters were a little surprised by that because it's like, well, yeah, it's kind of obvious there's going to be sellers at this point. Are players and managers and coaches sometimes the last to accept that this is the reality, that you're going to sell, you're not going to buy, the front office is not in on you this year? Can that be like something that's hard to actually get through your mind when you're out there competing?
Well, I can tell you when you're managing, you know, and it's your team and you're responsible for how they're playing. Yeah, it can be shocking. And I think the players the same way. There's certain guys, especially, you know, if it's the guys who are your everyday players who think, hey, look, we got a shot here. And all of a sudden now they move a pretty big piece and you're saying, well, wait a minute, well, you know, am I next? Am I going to be the next guy to go? I mean, you know, I looked at it in 2017. I mean, we just come off two playoff appearances and our pitching staff was injured. Next thing you know, Granderson's gone, Duda's gone, and all of a sudden the pieces started to fall away. And I will tell you, the attitude in that clubhouse was dramatically changed.
It's human nature, I would think. You're out there fighting every day, and then the message comes in from above that this isn't your year. It's got to be really hard to be as motivated. I mean, they're professionals, but it's more motivating to be in a race, I am sure. So, yeah, I'll bet that was deflating. What was harder for you, the 11-1 or the 17-1 for the clubhouse and for you?
Well, I kind of, you know, when I came there in 11, I kind of had an idea that we were in a time of we're going to start to make some changes. We're going to change the organization around a little bit. So I was a little bit aware of that. In 17, obviously, you know, we again coming off two playoffs, and we thought we'd put together a really good pitching staff. And sure enough, you know, Matt's out. Matsy's hurt. Syndergaard, that was your Syndergaard's. Jake had a bad 6 weeks at a time. And so all of a sudden, and then now all of a sudden, hey, look, we're out of this when we're dropping the pieces off a team that, you know, came into that in that season like we had a chance to win. So that was a little tougher for me.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I'm going to kind of lighten the mood a little bit. I'm going to ask Andy a non-baseball question.
Let's have it.
And, you know, Andy, I've watched several of your interviews, and there always seems to be something Beatles-related in the background. I was fortunate enough to see them live.
Oh, wow.
I was at Shea Stadium. I know because I heard an interview you did that, you know, your concert, you know, the one that you would always want to see. But when did your love for the Beatles start, and how big of a fan are you?
Wow. Well, I got to ask you, where were you sitting and could you hear? And then I'll answer
your
question.
Oh, my goodness. It was my dad got the tickets, and it was there were like four rows in back of the Mets dugout. And the Beatles were at second base. They were really good seats. And my dad had gotten tickets from his boss at the time, and I wasn't even supposed to go. It was my dad, my sister, and her three girlfriends. And one of her girlfriends couldn't make it at the last minute. And I was a Beatles nut. I mean, in 1964, when they came to America and they made their debut on Ed Sullivan, I was 6 or 7. And I'm calling the Plaza Hotel trying to talk to them at that time. So I was always Beatles nut. So when my sister's girlfriend couldn't make it, she was going to ask another friend, and I start crying. I was like, please let me go, you know, and my dad's like, Johnny's going, you know, that's it. In regard to hearing, it was almost impossible. They had about 10 opening acts, and when they made it, you couldn't hear a thing, and all I remember was like this insane, all of these girls around me, like one girl threw me off of my seat and she bit through a pencil screaming Paul's name, and it was just what an amazing experience. And and they only played 35 minutes or whatever it was. Life-changing, and just to be there. And one of my sister's girlfriends tried to jump on the field, so it was insane. It was insanity, but that was, for me, you know, my very first concert, very memorable, and I've been a Beatles nut since Ed Sullivan. Let's put it that way.
That's great. I mean, you know, I wasn't born until 1980, but I've probably been a fan since Ed Sullivan too, because it's so in my DNA from my dad and my parents. Yeah. I mean, it's just around as long as I was been aware of anything. And there's something about that. I mean, I love all kinds of music. I love to continue to learn. Like, the great thing about music is you can have something like, it was only about 4 or 5 years ago that I like discovered jazz really. And now there's like a whole other rabbit hole you can go down. There's always more to discover, but the Beatles are the only thing I could just listen to over and over and over and over again without getting sick of. If I'm distracted or stressed out or something on a drive, just put on the Beatles channel. And it's something I'm never sick of. To ask how much am I a fan of the Beatles? Let's put it this way. Somehow we had a daughter 2 years ago, and I was somehow able to convince my wife. I still don't know how I pulled this off, because she's respectful of the Beatles, but not like I am. Where her middle name is ABBEY. So I mean, if I name my kid after Abbey Road, in a sense, I think that answers your question.
Absolutely. Have you ever seen McCartney live?
A couple of times, yeah. And there was one that was incredible. I won't bore you with these stories too much, but two quick ones. The first time I saw him wasn't until 2011 at the at Yankee Stadium. And I remember it was 2011 because it was the night that the news broke about K-Rod's save, whatever that vesting option thing was, Terry, that was driving you crazy. So I'm taking calls from the Daily News office about K-Rod's save totals. And I'm like, I'm at Paul McCartney. Call me tomorrow. Anyway, so it's all, the Mets are always there somewhere. But I remember he came out instead of playing Hello, Goodbye. And the way my wife describes it is I kept looking at him, looking at my wife and looking at him. Like, I couldn't believe that this guy was standing in front of me. I couldn't believe that was actually him. And then one more quick one. Last time I saw him was at MetLife a couple of years ago. And he did that thing you probably saw where he has John Lennon on the big screen now, the duet. And not to sound like a softy, but I've got my, at the time, 11-year-old son there who's also a fan. Moment that we had together just watching him, my son turns to me like with tears in his eyes and he goes, he hasn't seen his friend in 40 years and now he's singing with him. And it was just, it's very, very powerful stuff. So yeah. There you go.
There you go. I appreciate that very much. I have one last thing for you. Your new book, The Yankee Way, The Untold Inside Story of the Cashman Era, has been out for a little more than a month now. How's everything going so far with the book? The response, what type of experience has that been for you with a book that's kind of been widely just given rave reviews?
Well, thank you for asking. It was fun. I learned so much. You know, Billy Epler, who's lived a lot of that, so he's featured a lot in the book, gave me a compliment that I really appreciate after he read it. He said, you know what? I know you got all the Jeter, A-Rod, Torrey stuff, but this is a scouting book. And that's what's been so fun for me to talk about, John. Honoring people like Bill Livesey, who Terry knows, that we talked about, behind-the-scenes people that don't get credit. How did a guy named Ron Brand, a longtime scout for the Yankees, figure out that Scott Brosius was the guy to trade for? But because he sat in the Oakland Coliseum and sat on him and watched him all year. How did these decisions get made? Everyone calls G. Michael a super scout. Well, what does that mean? Well, Epler sat next to him when he was young, and he said, well, here's what it meant. He had a big legal pad, and he made a mark for every pitch with the velocity, a note or two. He watched the swings. He watched the batter in the on-deck circle. He watched things that I, as a writer, do not have a sharp enough eye to notice. So, John, what was so satisfying to me was learning that stuff and now being able to talk about it with people. And the newsy stuff, it's been good. The sales have been good. The response has been nice. And that's the stuff I'm passionate about sharing, because everybody knows everything about the Yankees. But I'm able to give a little bit of attention to some of these scouting people and unsung people, and that's been really fun.
Sounds like it could be a good documentary someday.
It could. That's a good call. You want to produce it?
Hey, you never know. Yeah, I just watched the Bronx Zoo 1990 documentary, three-parter, and I thought that was fascinating. You know, I remember those days. But when you think about your book and that inside story of the Cashman era, it does sound like something that could be turned into a documentary pretty easily.
I think so, too. He would have to participate to make it work, though, and he is so reluctant. It's funny. And the whole introduction of the book is Cashman doing this dance with me where was he going to be interviewed or not, which is pretty funny. But, I mean, he's still in the job, after all these years. So maybe when he retires, he'll talk to a camera about that stuff. Who knows? Yeah,
well, continued success with it. Wishing you the best on that.
Thank you for that, John. I appreciate it.
TC, back to you.
All right. Well, Andy, thanks for being on. Appreciate it. It's always good to catch up. You know, you have lots of information and lots of stuff. You know, your contacts on the inside, you know, help perspective a lot. And so it's always fun to have you on and talk baseball with you, and look forward to seeing you really soon. And we'll have you on in another month. So we'll reassess where we are at that time.
Let's do it again anytime, guys. Always love coming on this show.
Thanks, Andy.
Once again, Terry, Andy Martino joining us today, and great insights, and it was great to have him on. Thank you for bringing him back on.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's really on top of things. He's got a great feel for what's going on. He's one of those writers, John, when he walks in the clubhouse, players and the coaches, they're not afraid to talk to Andy. They know he's not there to kill him. He's there to write a story, and he writes great stories. And of course, I think it's great that his book's successful right now. And, he's just fun to have around, because he does have some, contacts that he knows. He has a feel, has a little pulse on what's going on.
And your relationship with Andy goes back away. You could definitely, the mutual respect, the friendship between you two, and it's always great to see you two guys get together for a great baseball conversation. All right, we're going to feature a brand new segment here, Terry, and this is called the Amazing Hero of the Week. It highlights a story about a hero who shows the spirit of the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. So this will be the debut of our weekly segment brought to you by Tunnel to Towers. And this week, we will highlight Mets slugger Pete Alonso, the Amazing Hero of the Week.
Meeting with some of the firemen and first responders at the stadium, having some of them open up, and whether they're involved in 9/11 or just anything else, it's a really demanding job, and it can be an emotional one. Whether you lose a dear friend or get seriously hurt, like, that's a way different perspective than going 0-for-4. As a player of the Mets, I feel like, for me, I have a responsibility to give back to such a strong and gracious community.
Pete, you did it. How much fun was that?
That was a blast. I'm just happy that I could donate 5% of this money to Tunnels to Towers. I mean, I have the utmost respect for the people that put their lives on the line every single day.
When we found Tunnels to Towers, it was like, this is perfect. This is authentically New York. It was a no-brainer for us.
I came from a military background. Both my grandpas served. I mean, I feel really strongly about people who put their lives on the line every single day. And for me, I think that's kind of overlooked every once in a while. It's something that we all kind of take for granted. Hopefully other people can be inspired to help out.
Our foundation will take this money because of you, Pete, and we can help others to make sure that when they go out and they protect our country, or they protect our community, and when they leave their family behind, that we are going to take care of these families. And I thank you for that, and God bless you.
That moment, so incredibly like heartfelt and heartwarming, and just seeing the good immediately right away and the impact, that's really important, and I'm so happy to do it. Heroes don't wear capes. Like, heroes are just regular people that just do incredibly exceptional things. Hey, I'm Pete Alonso. Let's go Mets, and let's help the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
Go to t2t.org for more information about how your donation can make a difference.
What a great piece that was on Alonso. And you know, after that home run derby win, he donated money to Tunnel. He's been supporting that foundation for many years now. Yeah. So that was great.
It's great, John. I'm going to tell you, I've known Pete since he first came to the Mets. Special, special human being. So respectful of the city, what it means, Tunnels to Towers. Very respectful guy. Mets are a very, very lucky organization that he's part of it, and I hope he stays here a long time.
Yeah, I do too. We'll feature another amazing hero next week. It's brought to you by Tunnel to Towers. Your pledge of just $11 a month will transform the life of an injured service member, Gold Star family, or the family of a fallen first responder. Together, we can do good for these heroes. Go to T2T.org and donate today. Well, Terry, earlier today, we spoke to Mets Hall of Famer John Franco about his involvement with Tunnel to Towers as a member of the 2001 Mets. And of course, over all the years since then, John was a big part of the Mets outreach to the first responders after 9/11. So let's go to that interview right now. All right, here with John Franco, Hall of Fame pitcher for the New York Mets and legend in New York. And John, of course, I was with you last week and we were together with Jay Horowitz, one of your favorite people. And you were gracious enough to come on out and help the Tunnel to Towers Foundation by filming a PSA right at the World Trade Center. Can you tell us when that relationship with Tunnel to Towers started with you?
Sure. I used to live in Staten Island, and still a family lived in Staten Island. So when obviously the tragedy hit, and young Steve and Stilla had passed away in the towers, Frank decided to do this little run, the replica of his brother, you know, running through the tunnel. And I remember them starting out where they only had 500 runners at the time. To this day, they have over 30,000 run. And the good thing about me living downtown here is I look right out my window and I can see the runners coming through the tunnel and the path that Steven took. So I got to know Frank quite well. I helped out with Tunnels to Towers quite a bit. I used to be downstairs on the finish line welcoming people who had run, the firemen, police, military, just everybody. The whole area downtown gets shut off for the whole, you know, most of the day. It's the last Sunday in September that they do the run. So I got to know them and got to work with them and help them as much as I can. They do a tremendous job, not only for the police and firemen who have lost their lives, but also to the military who have lost their lives or the military who have been disabled, putting their lives on the line. So you and I can sleep great at night and put our heads on the pillow knowing that we're safe and we live in a country that is well protected.
Yeah, they actually, this past Memorial Day, they paid 36 mortgages across 20 states for those first responders and who really gave the ultimate sacrifice. You know, we're so proud to be associated with them. Terry cut a PSA for them down in Port St. Lucie recently. Pete Alonso has done the same, and your participation, it really helps the organization. But John, that horrific time at 9/11, you were one of you and the team, that 2001 team was so important to reach out to the first responders and do whatever you could do to help heal the city and the country. But the one event that sticks out, and I would like you to just kind of reminisce about the game, the first game back, what that meant to the city, what that Piazza home run meant to the country. So you were there. So kind of talk about that, if you would.
Well, the first game back in New York was really, I mean, the first game back was in Pittsburgh. And when we went to Pittsburgh, the fans in Pittsburgh were great. They had signs, "We're with you, New York. We love you, New York," chanting USA flags and stuff. You know, I think I had mentioned to you last week that we wore the policemen, firemen, NYPD hats in Pittsburgh, and the commissioner told us that we couldn't wear them no more. And Todd Zeal was our player rep at the time. And he came back and told us that we couldn't wear the hats. And we told them to tell the commissioner to go take a walk because we're going to wear the hats. And they said they're going to fine us. And we said, well, you can fine us as much as you can. Have them come down here and take the hats off our heads. Gratefully that Mr. Wilpon stepped in and we got to wear the hats for the rest of the season. And like I said last week, I would hope that they could wear it just for the game on 9/11. Both New York Yankees and the Mets could wear those hats on 9/11. It would be great for them to do that. But getting back to that game back in New York, things were so differently that, you know, driving to the ballpark that day, when you pull into the player's lot, you had the police right at the gate with the bomb-sniffing dogs, and they would look at your car, open your trunk, see if there's any bombs in it. Walking through the tunnel, there were police everywhere in the tunnel. as you're walking in, there were snipers on top of the scoreboard and top of the stadium. You go in the locker room. It was just like a normal day, but we weren't sure if it was the right thing to do, even though the president and the mayor said, let's get back to playing baseball. As we went in the locker room, I never, Turk Wendell, who was always a jokester, was asking one of the policemen with the dog, bomb sniffing dogs, that, you know, how good is this dog? And I'll never forget that put the dog in the hallway. He got some gunpowder and put it in Turk's locker. Came back in, the dog went around a couple times and sat right in front of Turk's locker. That's how good that dog was. We played, you know, the game. Police and firemen came out for the national anthem. Obviously, one of the few rare sights that we got along with the Braves was shaking hands and hugging with them before the game. Then the game was being played, and the crowd was kind of subdued, some laid back. You know, it was very a big crowd. But then once Mike hit that home run, you know, like I told you, when I talk about it, the hair stands up on my arms. Mike hit that home run. It was just like a big sign of relief. You know, you look in the stands and people were crying, hugging, chanting USA, just put a big smile on their faces. And like I said, for the 3 hours that we played the game, we put a little Band-Aid on a big wound. You know, we made the fans forget about what was going on down at ground zero, but obviously you're never going to forget what happened, but we put a little Band-Aid on a big wound for that 3 hours. Liza Minnelli coming out singing, doing the kicks with the fireman and policeman, hugging Jay Payton on the on-deck circle, Mark Anthony singing the national anthem. It was just something I'll never forget. I think, you know, as a team, the 2001 team, we, like I said, we did our part as much as we can to help the city heal.
Yes, you did. That home run, it kind of gave everybody a chance to be happy after such horrific weeks previous to that. But John, we appreciate your your recalling that and your memories of that, and we also certainly appreciate you coming out to the Trade Center last week to do that PSA for Tunnel to Towers. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Anytime to help the city, that's for sure.
John Franco will be back on Talking with TC next week when we get an opportunity to speak to him about his incredible career in the game and one of the greatest relief pitchers of all time. So we look forward to next week's special show with John Franco. And Terry, that's going to about wrap it up for this week. I know you have a really busy week coming up.
Yeah, I'm going to New York. I'm going to go watch, see Daryl Strawberry have his number retired and spend some time with him over the weekend, and then do some SNY next week, and then followed by the following weekend to do the post-game shows for the Mets when they're in London. So it's going to be fun. Looking forward to getting up there and seeing a lot of friends. But I'm so excited, John, about Tunnels to Towers joining our podcast, and I look forward to many, many more good shows.
Yes, we are so appreciative of them, and I wish you the best up in New York. I know you're going to be really busy, but enjoy yourself as much as you can up there, up in the Big Apple. I just want to remind everybody, you can follow Terry on X and Instagram at @TerryCollins_10. And for those of you on Facebook, there is a page there simply called The Terry Collins Show. You can follow me on X and Instagram at John Arezzi. And make sure to subscribe now to The Terry Collins Show wherever you listen to your favorite podcast and on our YouTube channel. Until next time, this is John Arezzi for Terry Collins. Have a great week, everyone.